Let's return to our verse-by-verse study of the book of Deuteronomy, where Moses is on the plains of Moab in the 11th month of the 40th year, just a few weeks before Israel goes into the Promised Land, reminding them of how their relationship with God started. He goes all the way back, actually, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but now he's focused more upon what happened at Mount Sinai when God gave them the Ten Commandments, when he spoke to them out of the fire, without form, and gave them his expectations for their behavior. And when we get to the New Testament, we are reminded that a lot of these issues were to let the Israelis know that what they were engaging in already was inappropriate and it needed to stop. As Paul says, laws are intended for those breaking laws. It's to make people behave themselves. It's to put rules in place for those that would misbehave without those rules. And that's unfortunate that it has to be that way, but we know that there is something about humans that tends toward wanting to do things their own way, even to the detriment of other people. And so they have to have some of these rules to make them do the right thing. So Deuteronomy chapter 5, he gets into the actual giving of the commandments again. And so this is why this book is called Second Law, Deuteronomy. So Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel." And this word "hear," I'm going to teach you the Hebrew for it, Shema. It is a command, and it means listen. But it's not just simply listen. It has the intention of you need to do something about what I'm about to tell you. And it's one of the reasons you see Jesus say things like this in the New Testament. "He who has an ear to hear, let him hear." Because hearing is not just a function of the eardrum and the little ear bones and the tympanic membrane being rattled and that image or that bit of information being sent up to the brain. That's not just simply hearing. You need to do something about it. You need to obey. And that's why the word for hear in Hebrew can also stand for the word obey. So, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the rules that I speak in your hearing today, and you shall learn them and be careful to do them." See, that's the idea. Hear and do. "He who is our God made a covenant with us at Horeb." Now, Horeb is just another name for Mount Sinai. Horeb has to do with desert or dry. All right, verse 3. "Not with our fathers did he who is make this covenant." Now, the fathers here meaning Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, all of those right down to Moses' time. They didn't get this covenant that included the law. Verse 4. Actually, let's read 3 again. "Not with our fathers did he who is make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today." Now, it's only those in their 50s and 40s that were actually alive at the time that the Ten Commandments were spoken. And just because that's the way it works, it's probably only those in their upper 40s and those in their 50s that have a clear recollection of that event. But those guys are the leaders. And so they're the ones that Moses is really targeting. You guys were alive the day this happened, so you know what I'm talking about. This is different than what happened with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They did not receive what we received on this day. Verse 4. He who is spoke with you face to face at the mountain out of the midst of the fire, while I stood between he who is and you at that time to declare to you the word of he who is. So Moses says, I was acting as mediator that day. I was farther up on the mountain and you were down below, and God spoke, and then later I brought you more information. For you were afraid because of the fire, and you did not go up into the mountain. It's actually that God put boundaries by order between the people and the mountain to begin with. But when the presentation of God's arrival came to pass, it scared them all. And they were quite happy, I think, to stay behind those boundary markers. He said, and now he starts quoting, I am he who is your God. Now remember the divine name here. If you were to pronounce it out, as close as I think we can get from the ancient Hebrew, it would be Yahweh. Y-A-W-E-A. Yahweh. Because of things that happened through the intervening centuries, the Jewish people quit pronouncing it, and they substituted the Hebrew word Adonai, which means my Lord or my master, in place of it. And this becomes the Tetragrammaton, the four letters, YHWH. And in our English Bibles, it is very typical to present the divine name as a capital letter L, followed by slightly smaller but still capital letters O-R-D. And if you check the foreword or the introductory remarks in your own copy of the scripture, it will explain this to you. But I've been making the habit of just translating that word out into its close equivalent English, he who is. So just, it seemed like an appropriate place to remind you of that here. So God says, I am he who is your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me, or literally alongside me. So God presents command number one, I'm the only God, so don't be acting like there are other gods. Verse number 8, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in the heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, he who is your God, am a jealous God. So commandment number 2 was, don't make idols. Now, this is not a prohibition against artwork. That is very clear, I think, through Israel's earlier history. The Ark of the Covenant is artwork and represents real figures. Cherubim, the four-faced, four-winged angelic beings. It has, throughout the tabernacle, representations of these cherubim. When the temple is later designed by David at the Holy Spirit's direction and given to Solomon to build, it has representations of animals, such as bulls, that are holding up the great big water tank made in copper, bronze, in order to hold the water for purification that goes on in all the ceremonies each day. That was not an idol. That was artwork. But in later years, the Jewish people did start interpreting this as impacting on any type of imagery. If it was a living animal or a living person, it shouldn't be represented. When you read Josephus, you find out that in the time period of the first century, B.C. and A.D., I think, Jewish people would not represent humans in any form or fashion. They didn't want them on their coinage. They did not want them as statues. And they also did the same thing when it came to animals. They would not let them be represented in 2D or 3D form. It was against their rules of the time. And Josephus even makes this false claim that Solomon broke the commandment by making the bulls to go under the Bronze Sea. Now, he was wrong, because it was God that told David, who told Solomon to build those statues to be used in the artwork for the temple. So I just want you to see here that those of us that appreciate artwork and will appreciate statuary and things like that, that might even represent historical figures like Jesus, that is not what this is going against. It is going against turning them into worship figures. So if you bow down in front of a statue of Jesus, you are technically violating this, because you've made a graven image that you bowed down to. But if you've just made it as some sort of artwork, that is a different story altogether. Okay? Now, there's room for us to debate about all of that, because if you feel very strongly that there shouldn't be anything like that around at all, then that's fine. I will honor that when I'm around you. But you need to not condemn me if I make it very clear this is artwork only. It is not an object of worship. Okay, so you shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, he who is your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me. Now that's repercussions. That is consequences, not condemnation. God is not sending the children of idolaters to hell for their father's idolatry or their grandchildren, but his judgment upon their dad or their granddad will in fact impact on them. They may be they may lose property, they may lose wealth, they may lose their dad or the grandfather because he dies, because God takes him out of the equation. Consequences are different than punishment guilt. And that is why I do not believe in the inheritance of original sin. We were not condemned to hell because of Adam and Eve's choice. We were condemned to hell for our own choice to sin. It's as simple as that. And this is upheld later. We'll be reading it later in the book of Deuteronomy, that God says you will not punish the children for their father's crime, or vice versa. Everyone needs to be punished for their own crime. All right, so he brings out this idea that I will bring judgment that impacts beyond the person that it's hitting, but, verse 10, showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. So he prefers to have the positive relationship. And he mentions that here, even in the context of judgment. So the first two rules, no other gods, don't make idols. Rule number three is in verse 11. You shall not take the name of he who is your God in vain, For he who is will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Now, taking his name in vain, I always just shortcut it this way. If you're not talking to him or about him, you should not be mentioning his name. So taking the name of God in vain is speaking inappropriately about him. Taking his name in vain is making a vow in his name with no intention of keeping it, or taking his name as a vow and then not keeping it. That's taking it in vain. So we need to take God seriously and speak honorably about his name. Verse number 12, rule number 4. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as he who is your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to he who is your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or your ox or your donkey or any of your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates, that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and he who is your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, he who is your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. Now, this commandment is very specifically for the Israeli people. It was given because they went years, decades, several centuries as slaves in Egypt, never getting time off, never getting a day off, no vacations. And so God makes part of the rule of this nation, there is a national day of rest so that no one can be forced to do work on this day, which is the seventh day of the week. And from a Jewish calendar system, it would be from sunset on Friday until sunset on Saturday night. That's the Sabbath day. And so it was a protected day off for everyone living in the land of the Israelis, with some minor exceptions. Obviously, priests have to work on the Sabbath day in order to get their work done. They more than likely got a comp day off, which brings me then to the principle, I think, for our New Testament era. And that is, everybody needs to take a day off and relax and enjoy time off with your family, your friends, and with your God. Now, there was a time in American history, and it actually came out of European history, that the church decided that day off should be Sunday, because that was the day that the Lord resurrected from the dead. Now, unfortunately, and I have to be honest about this, there was a little bit of anti-Semitism involved in that. The Jewish people took the Sabbath day off, and the Gentile Christians didn't want to be connected with the Jewish people. And so they picked the day of the Lord's resurrection, and they made that the protected day off. Right up into my memory time, when I was a kid, nothing was opened on Sunday. Nothing. No restaurants, nothing. And then it started changing. And first, a few places were open on Sunday, and then more and more, until we've arrived today, where pretty much everything is open on Sundays nowadays. It's a 7 days a week, 24-hour-a-day environment in our society. And everybody is running around and getting very little rest. So the principle does need to remain in place. Take a day off and rest and recuperate, and make sure that you worship the Lord and thank him that you got some time off to spend with your family and friends, okay? Verse number 16. Oh, wait a second. I want to go back one more thing on that. And don't judge other people if their day off is different than yours. That's a New Testament principle. Okay? Verse number 16. honor your father and your mother, as he who is your God commanded you, that your days may be long, and that it may go well with you in the land that he who is your God is giving you. So I actually was preaching a sermon this last Sunday from Ephesians chapter 6, Colossians chapter 3, and this passage is quoted in the Ephesians 6 passage as a reason why children need to obey their parents. So honor of mom and dad starts with obedience when you're a minor child. And the expectation is they're looking out for your best interests on behalf of God. And so you need to follow their lead because that will keep you safe. That's what this passage teaches. But the honor thing goes beyond our minor status into our majority years. When we are older and mom and dad are now getting older themselves, and we need to continue respecting them and thanking them for what they've done. And when time comes for them to be taken care of because of their declining years, we need to repay the favor and look out for them. And that is certainly a principle that is derived from this passage. Verse number 17, next rule. You shall not murder. Kill is too generic a word in this context because murder means to kill without appropriate reason. An execution of a criminal is not murder. When you are fighting in a war, and I'm assuming here that we've got a just war that's going on, and you kill someone in that environment, that is not murder. When someone breaks into your home, and it's the middle of the night, and you kill them, that is not murder, because they didn't belong there, and you didn't know what the circumstances were, and so you did what you could to protect yourself. So, you shall not murder needs to be communicated as it's intended here, and that is, you will not take people's lives without God-given reason. And the proper understanding is everybody is made in the image and likeness of God, and we need to respect that life gift that they have. Verse number 18, you shall not commit adultery. Adultery happens when marriage vows are broken and violated. Husband and wife come together in a marriage ceremony, in the witness of God and others, and that is a relationship that should not be intruded on by anyone else. When it is, that is a horrendous violation. And it was one of the capital crimes under the Old Testament law system. So here we see it addressed by God himself in the Ten Commandments. Don't cheat on your spouse. Verse number 19, you shall not steal. Private property is upheld in Scripture. And nobody should be taking somebody else's stuff without their permission, because that is theft. And it is against God's morality. Verse number 20, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor, meaning you don't lie about other people. Now, the false witness here is probably a much more technical sense of in a court of law. That's pretty bad. To go in a court of law where things are on the line and lie about it. And God is not going to wink at that. He's not going to overlook that. He will take that into consideration for matters of judgment. But lying as a whole, when you say things that are not true about someone else to tear them down, or in a strange, weird, twisted mindset to try to build yourself up, that is not appropriate. It is not showing respect for the image of God that dwells in that other person. So that is why we see that here in the Ten Commandments. In verse 21, We come to number 10. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. Covet meaning to desire, to have. It's a form of greediness. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not desire or covet your neighbor's house, his field, his male servant, his female servant, his ox, his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. Now, there is a fine point that we could make here. It is okay to look at your neighbor's house and go, man, I like that house. I wished I could have one like it. Or your neighbor's car. Wow, that is a nice car. I wished I could have one like it. That is not technically coveting that specific thing. So the technical way to break this is to think about how you could possess the very thing that your neighbor has. That's not right. But greediness can feed into that other thing that I was just talking about, where we've got that keep up with the Joneses idea, where we see that our neighbor has something that we like, and by golly, we want something just like it, maybe a little bit better than. And we've got to be cautious of that, because as the New Testament teaches us, greed is not good. It is equivalent to idolatry, and so very problematic. All right, so that's the Ten Commandments, and it wraps up here by saying, these words, he who is, spoke to all your assembly at the mountain, out of the midst of the fire, the cloud, and the thick darkness with a loud voice, and he added no more. So God spoke those 10 words, those 10 statements, and then he stopped speaking. And the verse says, and he wrote them on 2 tablets of stone and gave them to me. So the 10 commandments are a limited address by God, which was then written down for the intention of being kept by the Israeli people as a reminder of what happened on this special day.